Happiness is not mine, he said. He told me he was from Los Angeles. I guess that's nice, too, I said. The people are all phonies, he said. I wouldn't know about that, I said. That's why we took up residence here, he said. As my wife, my second wife, that is, told all the reporters at our wedding, we are getting away from all the phonies. We're going to live where people are really people. We're going to live in New Hampshire. My husband and I are going to find ourselves. He's going to write and write and write. He's going to write the most beautiful scenario anybody in the history of literature has ever written for me. That's nice, I said. You didn't read that in the newspapers or the magazines, he said. No, I said. I used to go out with a girl who subscribed to Film Fun, but that was years ago. I have no idea what happened to her. Somewhere in the course of this conversation, a fifth of a gallon of Old Hickey's private stock sour mash bourbon was evaporating, or was being stolen, or was otherwise disappearing fast. And I haven't got the conversation set down quite straight, because somewhere in there, Murrah told me he'd been married when he was only 18, and he told me who the John was he'd thought I was on the telephone. It hurt Murrah a lot to talk about John. John, he said, is my only child. 15 years old. Murrah clouded up, pointed southeast, only 22 miles away. So near and yet so far, he said. He didn't stay with his mother in Los Angeles, I said. His home is with her, said Murrah. But he goes to school at Mount Henry. Mount Henry is a very good boys' prep school near here. One of the reasons I came to New Hampshire was to be close to him. Murrah shook his head. I thought surely he'd get in touch with me sooner or later, return a telephone call, answer a letter. But he never did, I said. Never, said Murrah. You know what the last thing was he said to me? Nope, I said. When I divorced his mother and married Gloria Hilton, the last thing he said was, Father, you're contemptible. I don't want to hear another word from you as long as I live. That's strong, I said. Friend, said Murrah hoarsely, that's mighty strong. He bowed his head. That was the word he used. Contemptible. Young as he was, he sure used the right one. Did you finally get in touch with him today, I said. I called the headmaster of the school and I told him there was a terrible family emergency and he had to make John call me right away, said Murrah. It worked, thank God, he said, and even though I am definitely contemptible, he's agreed to come see me tomorrow. Somewhere else in that conversation, Murrah told me to look at the statistics sometime. I promised him I would. Just statistics in general or some special statistics, I asked him. Statistics on marriage, he said. I'm scared to think of what I'm liable to find, I said. You look at the statistics, said Murrah, and you'll find out that when people get married, when they're only 18, the way my first wife and I did, there's a 50-50 chance a thing will blow sky high. I was 18 when I married, I said. You're still with your first wife, he said. Going on 20 years now, I said. Don't you ever feel like you got gypped out of your bachelor days, your playboy days, your days as a great lover? Well, I said, in New Hampshire, those days generally come between the ages of 14 and 17. Let me put it to you this way, he said. Say you've been married all these years, fighting about the dumb things married people fight about, being broke and worried most of the time. I'm right with you, I said. And say the movies brought you a book you'd written, and they hired you to write the screenplay, and Gloria Hilton was going to be the star, he said. I don't think I can imagine that, I said. All right, he said, what's the biggest thing that could possibly happen to you in your line of work? I had to think a while. I guess it would be if I sold the Connors Hotel and putting Fleetwoods on every window. That must be 500 windows or more, I said. Good, he said. You've just made the sale. You got real money in your pocket for the first time. You've just had a fight with your wife, and you're thinking mean things about her, feeling sorry for yourself. And the manager of the hotel is Gloria Hilton. Gloria Hilton, looking the way she does in the movies. I'm listening, I said. Say you started putting up those 500 Fleetwoods, he said. And say every time you put up another storm window, there was Gloria Hilton smiling at you through the glass like you were a god or something. Is there anything left to drink in the house, I said. Say that went on for 3 months, he said, and every night you went home to your wife, some woman you'd known so long she was practically like a sister, and she would crab about some little thing. This is a very warm room, even without storm windows, I said. Say Gloria Hilton all of a sudden said to you, he said, dear to be happy, my poor darling. Oh, darling, we were made for each other. Dare to be happy with me. I go limp when I see you putting up storm windows. I can't stand to see you so unhappy, to know you belong to some other woman, to know how happy I could make you if only you belong to me. After that, I remember, Murrah and I went outdoors to look for thistles. He was going to show me how to grab thistles without getting hurt. I don't think we ever found any. I remember pulling up a lot of plants and throwing them against the house and laughing a lot, but I don't think any of the plants were thistles. Then we lost each other in the great outdoors. I yelled for him for a while, but his answers got fainter and fainter, and I finally went home. I don't remember what the homecoming was like, but my wife does. She says I spoke to her in a rude and disrespectful manner. I told her that I had sold 500 Fleetwood windows to the Connors Hotel. I also told her that she should look up the statistics on teenage marriages sometime. Then I went upstairs and took the door off our bathtub enclosure. I told her Murrah and I were trading doors. I got the door off and then I went to sleep in the tub. My wife woke me up and I told her to go away. I told her Gloria Hilton had just bought the Connors Hotel and I was going to marry her. I tried to tell her something very important about thistles, but I couldn't pronounce thistles, so I went to sleep again. So my wife poured bubble bath powder all over me, and she turned on the cold water faucet of the bathtub, and she went to bed in the guest room. About 3 o'clock the next afternoon, I went over to Murrah's to finish putting up his windows and to find out what we'd agreed to do about the bathtub enclosure door, if anything. I had two doors on the back of my truck, my door with a flamingo and his door with Gloria Hilton. I started to ring his doorbell, but then I heard somebody knocking on an upstairs window. I looked up and saw Murrah standing in the window of Gloria Hilton's bathroom. My ladder was already leaning against the sill of the window, so I went up the ladder and asked Murrah what was going on. He opened the window and told me to come in. He was very pale and shaky. Your boy showed up yet? I said. Yes, he said. He's downstairs. I picked him up at the bus station an hour ago. You two hitting it off all right? I said. Murrah shook his head. He's still so bitter, he said. He's only 15, but he talks to me as though he were my great-great-grandfather. I came up here for just a minute, and now I haven't got nerve enough to go back down. He took me by the arm. Listen, he said. You go down and sort of pave the way. If I've got any pavement left in me, I said, I'd better save it for home. I filled him in on my own situation at home, which was far from ideal. Whatever you do, he said, don't make the same mistake I made. You keep that home of yours together, no matter what. I know it must be lousy from time to time, but believe me, there are ways of life that are 10,000 times lousier. Well, I said, I thank the good Lord for one thing. What's that, he said. Gloria Hilton hasn't come right out and said she loved me yet, I said. I went downstairs to see Murrah's boy. Young John had on a man's suit. He even had on a vest. He wore big black-rimmed spectacles. He looked like a college professor. John, I said, I'm an old friend of your father's. That's so, he said, and he looked me up and down. He wouldn't shake hands. You certainly are a mature-looking young man, I said. I've had to be, he said. When father walked out on mother and me, that made me head of the family, wouldn't you say? Well now, John, I said, your father hasn't been too happy either, you know? That certainly is a great disappointment to me, he said. I thought Gloria Hilton made men as happy as they could possibly be. John, I said, when you get older, you're going to understand a lot of things you don't understand now. You must mean nuclear physics, he said. I can hardly wait. And he turned his back to me and he looked out the window. Where's father, he said. Here he is, said Murrah from the top of the stairs. Here the poor fool is, he came creaking down the stairs. I think I'd better go back to school, father, said the boy. So soon, said Murrah. I was told there was an emergency or I wouldn't have come, said the boy. There doesn't seem to be any emergency, so I'd like to go back, if you don't mind. Don't mind, said Murrah. He held out his arms. John, he said, you'll break my heart if you walk out on me now without... Without what, father, said the boy. He was cold as ice. Without forgiving me, said Murrah. Never, said the boy. I'm sorry, that's one thing I'll never do. He nodded. Whenever you're ready to go, father, he said, I'll be waiting in the car. And he walked out of the house. Murrah sat down in a chair with his head in his hands. What do I do now, he said. Maybe this is the punishment I deserve. I guess what I do is just grit my teeth and take it. I can only think of one other thing, I said. What's that, he said. Kick him in the pants, I said. So that's what Murrah did. He went out to the car, looking all gloomy and blue. He told John something was wrong with the front seat, and he made John get out so he could fix it. Then Murrah let the boy have it in the seat of his pants with the side of his foot. I don't think there was any pain connected with it, but it did have a certain amount of loft. The boy did a kind of polka downhill toward the shrubbery where his father and I had been looking for thistles the night before. When he got himself stopped and turned around, he was certainly one surprised-looking boy. John, Murrah said to him, I'm sorry I did that, but I couldn't think of anything else to do. For once, the boy didn't have a snappy comeback. I have made many serious mistakes in my life, said Murrah, but I don't think that was one of them. I love you, and I love your mother, and I think I'll go on kicking you until you can find it in your heart to give me another chance. The boy still couldn't think of anything to say, but I could tell he wasn't interested in being kicked again. Now you come back in the house, said Murrah, and we'll talk this thing over like civilized human beings. When they got back in the house, Murrah got the boy to call up his mother in Los Angeles. You tell her we're having a nice time and I've been terribly unhappy and I'm through with Gloria Hilton and I want her to take me back on any terms whatsoever, said Murrah. The boy told his mother, and she cried, and the boy cried, and Murrah cried, and I cried. And then Murrah's first wife told him he could come back home any time he wanted. And that was that. The way we settled the bathtub enclosure door thing was that I took Murrah's door and he took mine. Actually, I was trading a $22 door for a $48 door, not counting the picture of Gloria Hilton. My wife was out when I got home. I hung the new door. My own boy came up and watched me. He was red-nosed about something. Where's your mother? I said to him. She went out, he said. When she due back, I said. She said maybe she'd never come back, said the boy. I was sick, but I didn't let the boy know it. That's one of her jokes, I said. She says that all the time. I never heard her say it before, he said. I was really scared when supper time rolled around, and I still didn't have a wife. I tried to be brave. I got supper for the boy and me, and I said, well, I guess she's been delayed somewhere. Father, said the boy. What, I said. What did you do to Mother last night? He said. He took a very high and mighty tone. Mind your own business, I said, or you're liable to get a swift kick in the pants. That calmed him right down. My wife came home at 9 o'clock, thank God. She was cheerful. She said she'd had a swell time just being alone, shopping alone, eating in a restaurant alone, going to a movie alone. She gave me a kiss, and she went upstairs. I heard the shower running, and all of a sudden I remembered the picture of Gloria Hilton on the bathtub enclosure door. Oh, my Lord, I said. I ran up the stairs to tell her what the picture was doing on the door, to tell her I would have it sandblasted off first thing in the morning. I went into the bathroom. My wife was standing up, taking a shower. She was just the same height as Gloria Hilton. so the picture on the door made kind of a mask for her. There was my wife's body with the head of Gloria Hilton on it. My wife wasn't sore. She laughed. She thought it was funny. "Guess who?" she said.
Deer in the Works, read by Dylan Baker. The big black stacks of the ilium works of the Federal Apparatus Corporation spewed acid fumes and soot over the hundreds of men and women who were lined up before the red brick employment office. It was summer. The ilium works, already the second largest industrial plant in America, was increasing its staff by one-third in order to meet armament contracts. Every 10 minutes or so, a company policeman opened the employment office door, letting out a chilly gust from the air-conditioned interior, and admitting three more applicants.
"Next three," said the policeman.
A middle-sized man in his late 20s, his young face camouflaged with a mustache and spectacles, was admitted after a 4-hour wait. His spirits and the new suit he'd bought for the occasion were wilted by the fumes and the August sun, and he'd given up lunch in order to keep his place in line. But his bearing remained jaunty. He was the last in his group of three to face the receptionist.
"Screw machine operator, ma'am," said the first man.
"See Mr. Carmody in booth 7, said the receptionist.
"Plastic extrusion, miss," said the next man.
"See Mr. Hoyt in booth 2, she said.
"Skill?"
she asked the urbane young man in the wilted suit.
"Milling machine? Jig borer?"
"Writing," he said. "Any kind of writing."
"You mean advertising and sales promotion?"
"Yes, that's what I mean." She looked doubtful.
"Well, I don't know. We didn't put out a call for that sort of people. You can't run a machine, can you?"
"Typewriter," he said jokingly. The receptionist was a sober young woman. "The company does not use male stenographers," she said.
"See Mr. Dilling in booth 26. He just might know of some advertising and sales promotion type job."
He straightened his coat and tie, forced a smile that implied he was looking into jobs at the works as sort of a lark. He walked into booth 26 and extended his hand to Mr. Dilling, a man of his own age.
"Mr. Dilling, my name is David Potter. I was curious to know what openings you might have in advertising and sales promotion and thought I'd drop in for a talk."
Mr. Dilling, an old hand at facing young men who tried to hide their eagerness for a job, was polite but outwardly unimpressed.
"Well, you came at a bad time, I'm afraid, Mr. Potter. The competition for that kind of job is pretty stiff, as you perhaps know. And there isn't much of anything open just now."
David nodded. "I see." He had had no experience in asking for a job with a big organization, and Mr. Dilling was making him aware of what a fine art it was if you couldn't run a machine. A duel was underway.
"But have a seat anyway, Mr. Potter."
"Thank you." He looked at his watch. "I really ought to be getting back to my paper soon."
"You work on a paper around here?"
"Yes. I own a weekly paper in Dorset, about 10 miles from Ilium."
"Oh, you don't say. Lovely little village. Thinking of giving up the paper, are you?"
"Well, no, not exactly. It's a possibility. I bought the paper soon after the war, so I've been with it for 8 years, and I don't want to go stale. I might be wise to move on. It all depends on what opens up."
"You have a family?" said Mr. Dilling pleasantly.
"Yes, my wife and 2 boys and 2 girls.
"A nice, big, well-balanced family," said Mr. Dilling. "And you're so young, too. 29, said David. He smiled. We didn't plan it to be quite that big. It's run to twins. The boys are twins, and then several days ago, the girls came.
You don't say, said Mr. Dilling. He winked. That would certainly start a young man thinking about getting a little security, eh? With a family like that?
Both of them treated the remark casually, as though it were no more than a pleasantry between two family men. It's what we wanted, actually, two boys, two girls, said David. We didn't expect to get them this quickly, but we're glad now. As far as security goes, well, maybe I flatter myself, but I think the administrative and writing experience I've had running the paper would be worth a good bit to the right people, if something happened to the paper.
One of the big shortages in this country, said Dilling philosophically, concentrating on lighting a cigarette, is men who know how to do things and know how to take responsibility and get things done. I only wish there were better openings in advertising and sales promotion than the ones we've got. They're important, interesting jobs, understand? But I don't know how you'd feel about the starting salary.
Well, I'm just trying to get the lay of the land now, to see how things are. I have no idea what salary industry might pay a man like me, with my experience.
The question experienced men like yourself usually ask is, how high can I go and how fast? And the answer to that is that the sky is the limit for a man with drive and creative ambition, and he can go up fast or slow, depending on what he's willing to do and capable of putting into the job. We might start out a man like you at, oh, say, $100 a week. But that isn't to say you'd be stuck at that level for 2 years or even 2 months.
I suppose a man could keep a family on that until he got rolling, said David.
You'd find the work in the publicity end just about the same as what you're doing now. Our publicity people have high standards for writing and editing and reporting, and our publicity releases don't wind up in newspaper editors' wastebaskets. Our people do a professional job and are well-respected as journalists. He stood. I've got a little matter to attend to. Take me about 10 minutes. Could you possibly stick around? I'm enjoying our talk.
David looked at his watch. Guess I could spare another 10 or 15 minutes. Dilling was back in his booth in 3 minutes, chuckling over some private joke.
Just talking on the phone with Lou Flammer, the publicity supervisor, needs a new stenographer. Lou's a card. Everybody here is crazy about Lou. Old weekly man himself. And I guess that's where he learned to be so easy to get along with. Just to feel him out for the hell of it, I told him about you. I didn't commit you to anything. Just said what you told me, that you were keeping your eyes open. And guess what Lou said?
Guess what, Nan? Said David Potter to his wife on the telephone. He was wearing only his shorts and was phoning from the company hospital. When you come home from the hospital tomorrow, you'll be coming home to a solid citizen who pulls down $110 a week. Every week. I just got my badge and passed my physical.
Oh, said Nan, startled. It happened awfully fast, didn't it? I didn't think you were going to plunge right in.
What's there to wait for?
Well, I don't know. I mean, how do you know what you're getting into? You've never worked for anybody but yourself, and don't know anything about getting along in a huge organization. I knew you were going to talk to the Ilium people about a job, but I thought you planned to stick with the paper another year anyway.
In another year, I'll be 30, Nan.
Well?
That's pretty old to be starting a career in industry. There are guys my age here who've been working their way up for 10 years. That's pretty stiff competition. And it'll be that much stiffer a year from now. And how do we know Jason will still want to buy the paper a year from now? Ed Jason was David's assistant, a recent college graduate whose father wanted to buy the paper for him. And this job that opened up today in publicity won't be open a year from now, Nan. Now was the time to switch. This afternoon. Nan sighed. I suppose. But it doesn't seem like you. The works are fine for some people. They seem to thrive on that life. But you've always been so free. And you love the paper. You know you do.
I do, said David. And it'll break my heart to let it go. It was a swell thing to do when we had no kids. But it's a shaky living now, with the kids to educate and all.
But, hun, said Nan, the paper is making money.
It could fold like that, said David, snapping his fingers. A daily could come in with a one-page insert of Dorset News, or...
Dorset likes its little paper too much to let that happen. They like you and the job you're doing too much.
David nodded. What about 10 years from now?
What about 10 years from now in the works? What about 10 years from now anywhere?
It's a better bet that the works will still be here. I haven't got the right to take long chances anymore, Nan. Not with a big family counting on me.
It won't be a very happy big family, darling, if you're not doing what you want to do. I want you to go on being happy the way you have been, driving around the countryside, getting news and talking and selling ads, coming home and writing what you want to write, what you believe in. You in the works?
It's what I've got to do.
All right, if you say so. I've had my say.
It's still journalism, high-grade journalism, said David.
Just don't sell the paper to Jason right away. Put him in charge, but let's wait a month or so, please.
No sense in waiting, but if you really want to, all right. David held up a brochure he had been handed after his physical examination was completed. Listen to this, Nan. Under the company's security package, I get $10 a day for hospital expenses in case of illness, full pay for 26 weeks, $100 for special hospital expenses. I get life insurance for about half what it would cost on the outside. For whatever I put into government bonds under the payroll savings plan, the company will give me a 5% bonus in company stock 12 years from now. I get 2 weeks vacation with pay each year, and after 15 years, I get 3 weeks. Get free membership in the company country club. After 25 years, I'll be eligible for a pension of at least $125 a month. And much more if I rise in the organization and stick with it for more than 25 years.
Good heavens, said Nan.
I'd be a damn fool to pass that up, Nan.
I still wish you'd waited until the little girls and I were home and settled, and you got used to them. I feel you were panicked into this.
No, no, this is it, Nan. Give the little girls a kiss apiece for me. I've got to go now and report to my new supervisor.
Your what?
Supervisor.
Oh, I thought that's what you said, but I couldn't be sure.
Goodbye, Nan.
Goodbye, David.
David clipped his badge to his lapel and stepped out of the hospital and onto the hot asphalt floor of the world within the fences of the works. Dull thunder came from the buildings around him. A truck honked at him, and a cinder blew in his eye. He dabbed at the cinder with a corner of his handkerchief and finally got it out. When his vision was restored, he looked about himself for Building 31, where
where his new office and supervisor were. Four busy streets fanned out from where he stood, and each stretched seemingly to infinity. He stopped a passerby who was in less of a desperate hurry than the rest. "Could you tell me, please, how to find Building 31, Mr. Flammer's office?" The man he asked was old and bright-eyed, apparently getting as much pleasure from the clangor and smells and nervous activity of the works as David would have gotten from April in Paris. He squinted at David's badge and then at his face.
"Just starting out, are you?"
"Yes, sir, my first day."
"What do you know about that?"
The old man shook his head wonderingly and winked.
"Just starting out. Building 31. Well, sir, when I first came to work here in 1899, you could see Building 31 from here, with nothing between us and it but mud. Now it's all built up. See that water tank up there, about a quarter of a mile? Well, Avenue 17 branches off there, and you follow that almost to the end, then cut across the tracks, and just starting out, eh? Well, I'd better walk you up there. Came here for just a minute to talk to the pension folks, but that can wait. I'd enjoy the walk."
"Thank you."
50-year man, I was," he said proudly,
and he led David up avenues and alleys, across tracks, over ramps and through tunnels, through buildings filled with spitting, whining, grumbling machinery, and down corridors with green walls and numbered black doors.
"Can't be a 50-year man no more," said the old man pityingly. "Can't come to work until you're 18 nowadays, and you got to retire when you're 65.
He poked his thumb under his lapel to make a small gold button protrude. On it was the number 50 superimposed on the company trademark.
"Something none of you youngsters can look forward to wearing someday, no matter how much you want one."
"Very nice button," said David. The old man pointed out a door.
"Here's Flammer's office. Keep your mouth shut till you find out who's who and what they think. Good luck."
Lou Flammer's secretary was not at her desk, so David walked to the door of the inner office and knocked.
"Yes," said the man's voice sweetly. "Please come in."
David opened the door. "Mr. Flammer?" Lou Flammer was a short, fat man in his early 30s. He beamed at David.
"What can I do to help you?"
"I'm David Potter, Mr. Flammer." Flammer's Santa Claus-like demeanor decayed. He leaned back, propped his feet on his desktop, and stuffed a cigar, which he had concealed in his cupped hand, into his large mouth.
"Hell, thought you were a scoutmaster."
He looked at his desk clock, which was mounted in a miniature of the company's newest automatic dishwasher.
"Boy Scouts touring the works. Supposed to stop in here 15 minutes ago for me to give him a talk on scouting and industry. 56% of Federal Apparatus's executives were Eagle Scouts."
David started to laugh, but found himself doing it all alone, and he stopped.
"Amazing figure," he said. "It is," said Flammer judiciously. "Says something for scouting and something for industry. Now, before I tell you where your desk is, I'm supposed to explain the rating sheet system. That's what the manual says. Dilling tell you about that?"
"Not that I recall. There was an awful lot of information all at once."
"Well, there's nothing much to it," said Flammer. "Every 6 months,
A rating sheet is made out on you, to let you and to let us know just where you stand and what sort of progress you've been making. Three people who've been close to your work make out independent ratings of you, and then all the information is brought together on a master copy with carbons for you, me, and personnel, and the original for the head of the advertising and sales promotion division. It's very helpful for everybody, you most of all, if you take it the right way. He waved a rating sheet before David. See? Blanks for appearance, loyalty, promptness, initiative, cooperativeness, things like that. You'll make out rating sheets on other people, too, and whoever does the rating is anonymous.
I see. David felt himself reddening with resentment. He fought the emotion, telling himself his reaction was a small-town man's, and that it would do him good to learn to think as a member of a great, efficient team.
"Now about pay, Potter," said Flemmer. "There'll never be any point in coming in to ask me for a raise. That's all done on the basis of the rating sheets and the salary curve."
He rummaged through his drawers and found a graph, which he spread out on his desk.
"Here. Now you see this curve? Well, it's the average salary curve for men with college educations in the company. See? You can follow it on up. At 30, the average man makes this much. At 40, this much, and so on. Now, this curve, above it shows what men with real growth potential can make. See? It's a little higher and curves upward a little faster. You're how old?"
29, said David, trying to see what the salary figures were that ran along one side of the graph. Flammer saw him doing it and pointedly kept them hidden with his forearm.
"Uh-huh."
Flammer wet the tip of a pencil with his tongue and drew a small X on the graph, squarely astride the average man's curve.
"There you are."
David looked at the mark and then followed the curve with his eyes across the paper, over little bumps, up gentle slopes, along desolate plateaus, until it died abruptly at the margin which represented age 65. The graph left no questions to be asked and was deaf to argument. David looked from it to the human being he would also be dealing with.
"You had a weekly once, did you, Mr. Flammer?"
Flammer laughed. "In my naive, idealistic youth, Potter, I sold ads to feed stores, gathered gossip, set type, and wrote editorials that were going to save the world, by God."
David smiled admiringly. "What a circus, eh?"
"Circus," said Flammer. "Freak show, maybe. It's a good way to grow up fast. Took me about 6 months to find out I was killing myself for peanuts. That a little guy couldn't even save a village 3 blocks long, and that the world wasn't worth saving anyway. So I started looking out for number one. Sold out to a chain, came down here, and here I am."
The telephone rang.
"Yes," said Flammer sweetly. "Publicity?"
His benign smile faded.
"No. You're kidding, aren't you?"
"Where?"
"Really? This is no gag?"
"All right. All right. Lord, what a time for this to happen. I haven't got anybody here, and I can't get away on account of the goddamn Boy Scouts."
He hung up.
"Potter, you've got your first assignment. There's a deer loose in the works."
"Deer?"
"Don't know how he got in, but he's in. Plumber went to fix a drinking fountain out of the softball diamond across from Building 217 and flushed a deer out from under the bleachers. Now they got him cornered up around the metallurgy lab."
He stood and hammered on his desk.
"Murder. The story will go all over the country, Potter. Talk about human interest. Front page.
Of all the times for Al Tappan to be out at the Ashtabula Works, taking pictures of a new viscometer they cooked up out there. All right, I'll call up a hack photographer downtown, Potter, and get him to meet you out by the metallurgy lab. You get the story, and see that he gets the right shots, okay?
He led David into the hallway.
Just go back the way you came. Turn left instead of right at the fractional horsepower motors. Cut through hydraulic engineering. Catch bus 11 on Avenue 9, and it'll take you right there. After you get the story and pictures, we'll get them cleared by the law division, the plant security officer, our department head, and buildings and grounds, and shoot them right out. Now get going. That deer isn't on the payroll. He isn't going to wait for you. Come to work today. Tomorrow, your work will be on every front page in the country if we can get it approved. The name of the photographer you're going to meet is McGarvey. Got it? You're in the big time now, Potter. We'll all be watching.
He shut the door behind David. David found himself trotting down the hall, down a stairway, and into an alley, brushing roughly past persons in a race against time. Many turned to watch the purposeful young man with admiration. On and on he strode, his mind seething with information. Flammer, Building 31, Deer, Metallurgy Lab, Photographer Al Tappan. No, Al Tappan and Ashtabula, Flinney, the hack photographer. No, McCammer. No, McCammer is new supervisor. 56% Eagle Scouts. Deer by Viscometer Laboratory. No, Viscometer and Ashtabula. Call Danner, new supervisor, and get instructions right. 3 weeks vacation after 15 years. Danner not new supervisor. Anyway, new supervisor in Building 319. No, Fanner in Building 399-819-83319. David stopped, blocked by a grimy window at the end of a blind alley. All he knew was that he'd never been there before, that his memory had blown a gasket, and that the deer was not on the payroll. The air in the alley was thick with tango music and the stench of scorched insulation. David scrubbed away some of the crust on the window with his handkerchief, praying for a glimpse of something that made sense. Inside were ranks of women at benches, rocking their heads in time to the music and dipping soldering irons into great nests of colored wires that crept past them on endless belts. One of them looked up and saw David and winked in tango rhythm. David fled. At the mouth of the alley, he stopped a man and asked him if he had heard anything about a deer in the works. The man shook his head and looked at David oddly, making David aware of how frantic he must look. "I heard it was out by the lab," David said more calmly.
"Which lab?" said the man.
"That's what I'm not sure of," said David. "There's more than one."
"Chemical lab?" said the man. "Materials testing lab? Paint lab? Insulation lab?"
"No, I don't think it's any of those," said David.
"Well, I could stand here all afternoon naming labs and probably not hit the right one. Sorry, I've got to go. You don't know what building they've got the differential analyzer in, do you?"
"Sorry," said David. He stopped several other people, none of whom knew anything about the deer, and he tried to retrace his steps to the office of his supervisor, whatever his name was. He was swept this way and that by the currents of the works, stranded in backwaters, sucked back into the mainstream, and his mind was more and more numbed, and the mere reflexes of self-preservation were more and more in charge. He chose a building at random and walked inside for a momentary respite from the summer heat, and was deafened by the clangor of steel sheets being cut and punched, being smashed into strange shapes by great hammers that dropped out of the smoke and dust overhead. A hairy, heavily muscled man was seated near the door on a wooden stool, watching a giant lathe turn a bar of steel the size of a silo. David now had the idea of going through a company phone directory until he recognized his supervisor's name. He called to the machinist from a few feet away, but his voice was lost in the din. He tapped the man's shoulder. "Telephone around here?" The man nodded. He cupped his hands around David's ear and shouted, "Up that and through the..." Down crashed a hammer. "Turn left and keep going until you..." An overhead crane dropped a stack of steel plates. "Four doors down from there is it. Can't miss it." David, his ears ringing and his head aching, walked into the street again and chose another door. Here was peace and air conditioning. He was in the lobby of an auditorium where a group of men were examining a box studded with dials and switches that was spotlighted and mounted on a revolving platform. "Please, miss," he said to a receptionist by the door, "could you tell me where I could find a telephone?"
"It's right around the corner, sir," she said. "But I'm afraid no one is permitted here today but the crystallographers. Are you with them?"
"Yes," said David.
"Oh, well, come right in. Name?"
He told her, and a man sitting next to her lettered it on a badge. The badge was hung on his chest, and David headed for the telephone. A grinning, bald, big-toothed man wearing a badge that said Stan Dunkel, Sales, caught him and steered him to the display.
"Dr. Potter," said Dunkel, "I ask you, is that the way to build an X-ray spectrogoniometer, or is that the way to build an X-ray spectrogoniometer?"
"Yes," said David, "that's the way, all right."
"Martini, Dr. Potter,"
said a maid offering a tray. David emptied the martini in one gloriously hot, stinging gulp.
"What features do you want in an X-ray spectrogoniometer, doctor?" said Dunkel.
"It should be sturdy, Mr. Dunkel," said David, and he left Dunkel there, pledging his reputation that there wasn't a sturdier one on Earth. In the phone booth, David had barely got through the telephone directory's A's before the name of his supervisor miraculously returned to his consciousness. Flammer. He found the number and dialed.
"Mr. Flammer's office," said a woman.
"Could I speak to him, please? This is David Potter."
"Oh, Mr. Potter. Well, Mr. Flammer is somewhere out in the works now, but he left a message for you. He said there's an added twist to the deer story. When they catch the deer, the venison is going to be used at the Quarter Century Club picnic."
"Quarter Century Club?" said David.
"Oh, that's really something, Mr. Potter. It's for people who've been with the company 25 years or more. Free drinks and cigars and just the best of everything. They have a wonderful time."
"Anything else about the deer?"
"Nothing he hasn't already told you," she said,
and she hung up. David Potter, with a third martini in his otherwise empty stomach, stood in front of the auditorium and looked both ways for a deer.
"But our X-ray spectrogoniometer is sturdy, Dr. Potter,"
Stan Dunkel called to him from the auditorium steps. Across the street was a patch of green, bordered by hedges. David pushed through the hedges into the outfield of a softball diamond. He crossed it and went behind the bleachers where there was cool shade, and he sat down with his back to a wire mesh fence which separated one end of the works from a deep pine woods. There were two gates in the fence, but both were wired shut. David was going to sit there for just a moment, long enough to get his nerve back, to take bearings. Maybe he could leave a message for Flammer, saying he had suddenly fallen ill, which was essentially true, or...
"There he goes!"
cried somebody from the other side of the diamond. There were gleeful cries, shouted orders, the sounds of men running. A deer with broken antlers dashed under the bleachers, saw David, and ran frantically into the open again along the fence. He ran with a limp, and his reddish-brown coat was streaked with soot and grease.
"Easy now. Don't rush him. Just keep him there. Shoot into the woods, not the works."
David came out from under the bleachers to see a great semicircle of men, several ranks deep, closing in slowly on the corner of fence in which the deer was at bay. In the front rank were a dozen company policemen with drawn pistols. Other members of the posse carried sticks and rocks and lariats hastily fashioned from wire. The deer pawed the grass and bucked and jerked its broken antlers in the direction of the crowd.
"Hold it!" shouted a familiar voice.
A company limousine rumbled across the diamond to the back of the crowd. Leaning out of a window was Lou Flammer, David's supervisor.
"Don't shoot until we get a picture of him alive," commanded Flammer.
He pulled a photographer out of the limousine and pushed him into the front rank. Flammer saw David standing alone by the fence, his back to a gate.
"Good boy, Potter," called Flammer. "Right on the ball. Photographer got lost, and I had to bring him here myself."
The photographer fired his flash bulbs. The deer bucked and sprinted along the fence toward David. David unwired the gate, opened it wide. A second later, the deer's white tail was flashing through the woods and gone. The profound silence was broken first by the whistling of a switch engine and then by the click of a latch as David stepped into the woods and closed the gate behind him. He didn't look back.
The Lie, read by David Strathairn. It was early springtime. Weak sunshine lay cold on old gray frost. Willow twigs against the sky showed the golden haze of fat catkins about to bloom. A black Rolls Royce streaked up the Connecticut Turnpike from New York City. At the wheel was Ben Barkley, a black chauffeur.
"Keep it under the speed limit, Ben," said Dr. Remenzel. "I don't care how ridiculous any speed limit seems, stay under it. No reason to rush. We have plenty of time." Ben eased off on the throttle.
"Seems like in the springtime she wants to get up and go," he said.
"Do what you can to keep her down, okay?" said the doctor.
"Yes, sir," said Ben.
He spoke in a lower voice to the 13-year-old boy who was riding beside him, to Eli Remenzel, the doctor's son.
"Ain't just people and animals feel good in the springtime," he said to Eli. "Motors feel good, too."
"Hum," said Eli.
"Everything feel good," said Ben. "Don't you feel good?"
Sure, I feel good," said Eli emptily.
"Should feel good, going to that wonderful school," said Ben.
The wonderful school was the White Hill School for Boys, a private preparatory school in North Marston, Massachusetts. That was where the Rolls-Royce was bound. The plan was that Eli would enroll for the fall semester, while his father, a member of the class of 1939, attended a meeting of the Board of Overseers of the school.
"Don't believe this boy's feeling so good, doctor," said Ben.
He wasn't particularly serious about it. It was more genial springtime blather.
"What's the matter, Eli?"
said the doctor absently. He was studying blueprints, plans for a 30-room addition to the Eli Remenzel Memorial Dormitory, a building named in honor of his great-great-grandfather. Dr. Remenzel had the plans draped over a walnut table that folded out of the back of the front seat. He was a massive, dignified man, a physician, a healer for healing's sake, since he had been born as rich as the Shah of Iran.
"Worried about something?"
he asked Eli without looking up from the plans.
"Nope," said Eli.
Eli's lovely mother, Sylvia, sat next to the doctor, reading the catalog of the White Hill School. "If I were you," she said to Eli, "I'd be so excited I could hardly stand it. The best 4 years of your whole life are just about to begin." "Sure," said Eli. He didn't show her his face. He gave her only the back of his head, a pinwheel of coarse brown hair above a stiff white collar to talk to. "I wonder how many Remenzels have gone to White Hill," said Sylvia.
"That's like asking how many people are dead in a cemetery," said the doctor.
He gave the answer to the old joke and to Sylvia's question, too.
"All of them."
"If all the Remenzels who went to White Hill were numbered, what number would Eli be?" said Sylvia. "That's what I'm getting at." The question annoyed Dr. Remenzel a little. It didn't seem in very good taste.
"It isn't the sort of thing you keep score on," he said.
"Guess," said his wife.
"Oh," he said, "you have to go back through all the records, all the way back to the end of the 18th century, even, to make any kind of guess. And you'd have to decide whether to count the Schofields and the Haleys and the McClellans as Remenzels."
"Please make a guess," said Sylvia. "Just people whose last names were Remenzel."
"Oh," the doctor shrugged, rattled the plans. 30, maybe?"
"So, Eli is number 31, said Sylvia, delighted with the number. "You're number 31, dear," she said to the back of Eli's head.
Dr. Remenzel rattled the plans again. "I don't want him going around saying something asinine like he's number 31, he said.
"Eli knows better than that," said Sylvia. She was a game, ambitious woman with no money of her own at all. She had been married for 16 years, but was still openly curious and enthusiastic about the ways of families that had been rich for many generations.
"Just for my own curiosity, not so Eli can go around saying what number he is," said Sylvia, "I'm going to go wherever they keep the records and find out what number he is. That's what I'll do while you're at the meeting, and Eli's doing whatever he has to do at the admissions office."
"All right," said Dr. Remenzel. "You go ahead and do that."
"I will," said Sylvia. "I think things like that are interesting, even if you don't."
She waited for a rise on that, but didn't get one. Sylvia enjoyed arguing with her husband about her lack of reserve and his excess of it. Enjoyed saying, toward the end of arguments like that,
"Well, I guess I'm just a simple-minded country girl at heart, and that's all I'll ever be, and I'm afraid you're going to have to get used to it."
But Dr. Remenzel didn't want to play that game. He found the dormitory plans more interesting.
"Will the new rooms have fireplaces?" said Sylvia.
In the oldest part of the dormitory, several of the rooms had handsome fireplaces.
"That would practically double the cost of construction," said the doctor.
"I want Eli to have a room with a fireplace, if that's possible," said Sylvia.
"Those rooms are for seniors."
"I thought maybe through some fluke," said Sylvia.
"What kind of fluke do you have in mind?" said the doctor. "You mean I should demand that Eli be given a room with a fireplace?"
"Not demand," said Sylvia.
"Request firmly," said the doctor.
"Maybe I'm just a simple-minded country girl at heart," said Sylvia, "but I look through this catalog, and I see all the buildings named after Remenzels. Look through the back and see all the hundreds of thousands of dollars given by Remenzels for scholarships. And I just can't help thinking people named Remenzel are entitled to ask for a little something extra."
"Let me tell you in no uncertain terms," said Dr. Remenzel, "that you are not to ask for anything special for Eli. Not anything."
"Of course I won't," said Sylvia. "Why do you always think I'm going to embarrass you?"
"I don't," he said.
"But I can still think what I think, can't I?" she said.
"If you have to," he said.
"I have to," she said cheerfully, utterly unrepentant. She leaned over the plans. "You think those people will like those rooms?"
"What people?" he said.
"The Africans," she said.
She was talking about 30 Africans who, at the request of the State Department, were being admitted to Whitehill in the coming semester. It was because of them that the dormitory was being expanded. "The rooms aren't for them," he said. "They aren't going to be segregated." "Oh," said Sylvia. She thought about this a while, and then she said, "Is there a chance Eli will have to have one of them for a roommate?" "Freshmen draw lots for roommates," said the doctor. "That piece of information's in the catalog, too." "Eli," said Sylvia. "Hmm?" said Eli. "How would you feel about it if you had to room with one of those Africans?" Eli shrugged listlessly. "That's all right," said Sylvia. Eli shrugged again. "I guess it's all right," said Sylvia.
"It had better be," said the doctor.
The Rolls-Royce pulled abreast of an old Chevrolet, a car in such bad repair that its back door was lashed shut with clothesline. Dr. Remenzel glanced casually at the driver, and then, with sudden excitement and pleasure, he told Ben Barkley to stay abreast of the car. The doctor leaned across Sylvia, rolled down his window, yelled to the driver of the old Chevrolet, "Tom! Tom!" The man was a Whitehill classmate of the doctor. He wore a Whitehill necktie, which he waved at Dr. Remenzel in gay recognition. And then he pointed to the fine young son who sat beside him, conveyed with proud smiles and nods that the boy was bound for Whitehill. Dr. Remenzel pointed to the chaos of the back of Eli's head, beamed that his news was the same. In the wind blustering between the two cars, they made a lunch date at the Holly House in North Marston, at the inn whose principal business was serving visitors to Whitehill. "All right," said Dr. Remenzel to Ben Barkley. "Drive on." "You know," said Sylvia, "somebody really ought to write an article." And she turned to look through the back window at the old car now shuddering far behind. "Somebody really ought to."
"What about?" said the doctor.
He noticed that Eli had slumped way down in the front seat.
"Eli," he said sharply, "sit up straight."
He returned his attention to Sylvia. "Most people think prep schools are such snobbish things, just for people with money," said Sylvia, "but that isn't true." She leafed through the catalog and found the quotation she was after. "The Whitehill School